Holy shit, did you see that? Coming to your cordless, everybody. It's 11:02 on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 on the West Coast, and 10:02 here in Northeast Minneapolis. I'm Jim Peters. Welcome to another edition of Jim Peters at Night. This is episode number 20. We've done 20 of these shows before. So I don't know if you've noticed, it doesn't look much different, but it's longer. We have a new intro tonight that Alex K did for us. I liked the previous one so much. At 12 seconds, I said, do one longer. So we're going to use this one for the top of the show, and the other one is a bumper. And just to thrill you, I'm going to play it again. Here it is. He does great work. Thank you, Alex, for that. That's fantastic. Okay, so if you're wondering there, that is downtown Minneapolis. Downtown Minneapolis doesn't look a lot like Manhattan. It does, especially there's a big, tall building. Matter of fact, hold on a second. When I move here, you can see it. It's right behind my head. See that? It kind of looks like Rockefeller Center. That's actually the Northwest Bank Tower. It was designed to look like Rockefeller Center. Cesar Pelli designed that. That building is only about 30 years old, but it was an homage to the Rockefeller Center, and it does look a lot like that. And there's a lot of 60-story buildings in downtown Minneapolis, and there you go, that's one of them. So anyway, what else you want to know? I'll tell you one more thing, too, on that. If you're wondering, a couple people asked me, what is the theme music we're using? I did that. You know, I spent most of my life as a professional musician, little techno piece I did, never knew what to call it. I call it Midtown just because I couldn't come up with a title for it. But anyway, that's it. So there you go. So what do we got going on? Tonight, Dr. Murray Sabrin is going to be joining us. He was the inaugural guest on the show on July 31st. So he's coming back. There's about a handful of people I have back every 4 to 6 weeks. Just, now it sounds like I'm stacking them. I'm being desperate, but that's not what's happening here. Jazz Shaw is coming back tomorrow. He was on our 7th program. It is still, to this point, the highest watched program we've done. About 2,500 people have seen it. And so he's coming back. He's, you know, I call him my brother from another mother. He has the same gig I've had for years, and that is he talks about conservative news. I can talk. He talks about that, and he talks about UFOs. That's what he knows about. That's what I know about. It's like we get together. It's like a, you know, fun fest, you know. And so next week, also joining us, another one of our previous guests, Mark Tapscott, the congressional correspondent for the Epoch Times. Now, normally, I do not actually announce guests until I actually know the day they're coming on. Mark's coming on sometime next week. We haven't put the day yet, but I know he's coming on because his rep called me and said, Mark wants to come on your show again. Okay, that's great. Thank you. Thank you. Apparently, Mark has a lot to talk about. So he called us. And so we figure he's going to be on sometime next week. I'm also working on a guy, and him I'm not going to name because he's never been on the program before. I've never interviewed him before. You know, this goes back years at this point. I've done podcasts, radio shows, all sorts of stuff. So I've talked to a lot of people. But he's written a book about the history of American football, especially on the collegiate level. And, yeah, that we're going to talk to him about him too. So. He's agreed to come on, haven't set the day yet, haven't figured it out. So I got a couple of things going on here, you know, a lot of stuff going on, folks, a lot of stuff. But let me tell you about another thing that's going on, too, which kind of has me pissed off, and it might be my own fault. We are not broadcasting live on Podbean, not live tonight. That's our audio-only broadcaster distributor, because I found out, as a matter of fact, I'll tell you, Chris Williamson, who is the guy from the Vantage podcast we had on about a week ago, 10 days ago, I think it was, he let me know. He said, Jim, people have tried to hear the Podbean podcast, and my voice doesn't show up. And I'm thinking, well, that's weird. So I went back and checked, and yeah, sure enough, I'm interviewing him, and you can hear me and not him. And then I listened to the other previous shows we've all done on podcasts, you know, the previous, like, 19 of them. I listened to a few of them, and none of those shows have recorded correctly. None of them. And this has been a huge pain in the ass because I'll tell you, the problem is, so I have a soundboard and a mixer here. And as a matter of fact, you can actually see I have a big time microphone. So because my voice to sound nice, because I got a nice voice. I got a nice radio voice. I don't have a nice TV face. I don't. I'm thinking about wearing contact lenses. I do have contacts. I'm too lazy to put them in. I'm actually thinking because the reflection from the lights here and also with the green screen in the background, I know that sometimes you can't see my eyes or whatever, and it's just bullshit. So I'm thinking, just bite the bullet and put the contacts on, especially because I don't have to put any makeup on here. Because the real pain in the ass is putting on makeup and wearing contacts. Because then you get the makeup in your eyes, and oh, God. I've done a lot of television, folks, and to me, maybe it's because I'm a man, I don't wear makeup on a daily basis, but the makeup is by far the worst thing. And I swore to God when we do this, I'm not going to wear makeup, and so far I haven't had to, even though I got a really, really red face, and yeah, we've been fucking with the lights here for the last month, but I'm not going to put the makeup on. I'm not going to. Okay, what was I talking about? Oh, the fact that we screwed the audio up on the Podbean Live. What happened is that I got this big mixer, this audio thing here, and my microphone, but it turns out the Podbean was taking the audio off directly off my camera, and that's why you can't hear anything other than my voice, and I'm pissed off. First of all, this has been a pain in the ass since we started, and then I went back and I listened. Our broadcast provider here provides me with both an audio and a video file of every show. I went back to listen to some of the audio files, which were correct. Those files are correct because they're taken right off the video feed. And even still, I'm kind of surprised because, this has been an evolving process for me. And yeah, I know that there's a lot of people on Twitch and Rumble right now doing the same thing I'm doing, but no one's really doing it the exact same way. First of all, we take video phone calls here. And you see this thing right here? You go to that URL right there on your device. When we've had people calling on their phones, it works out just fine. There's a big blue button at the top of the screen. You hit the button, you end up in the queue. It's as simple as that. It's really simple. If you don't want your face on the screen, when you hit the button, you go to a preview screen. You can choose, instead of choosing the camera on your device is chosen by default, but you can click the drop down and go no video, and that essentially, I don't know what the term is, it mutes your camera, then you're audio only. And we've had people call in like that too. If you don't want your face on the screen, you don't have to do it. It's really simple. It's way simpler than even dialing a phone, So the thing is, my point is, Talkers Magazine did a story about this program before we started. And that's the first entry in our blog, on our show blog at jimandnight.com. So you go there if you want to read it. You can go there and take a look. It links to that. But the fact that no one's doing a show exactly like this. And I'm starting to realize, no, this is a video medium. I come from an audio background, mostly. I've done a lot of television. I did for about 3 years, I did a weekly talk show on public television here in Minneapolis. But I will now gather my thoughts. but that's good, Jim. Yeah, just face out right in the middle of that. That's terrific, Okay, all right, yep, old age. There we go. Now, what was I talking about? Okay, so I'm talking about the fact that this show's kind of different and that we're taking video phone calls. And I'm starting to realize, all right, I got back on the horse here. I started to realize this is a visual medium. Like, I'm not fooling anybody here. This is not a radio show with a picture. This is an actual television show. It really is. So the thing is, if you want to call up, especially for the third. Now, we've never done this before because I want to kind of ease into it. And also, we haven't had a lot of callers. If you want to call up during Murray's segment, did I mention Murray Sabrin's our guest tonight? Yeah, I did mention that. So we're going to talk about economics. If you have a question for Murray, you want to call in, please do so. I will take your call tonight. Otherwise, we generally leave calls for the third part of the show, where usually I talk about UFO shit and your calls. Is that's the idea, kind of. This show broken up into three basic parts. I do a little monologue, like I'm talking here at the top. We have a guest on, usually for about 30 or 40 minutes, and then we do a third section, which is supposed to be your phone calls, but, you know, right now, you guys aren't calling in much, so I'm kind of leaving the UFO news for there, even though I will talk about the UFO news regularly. So anyway, yeah, you give me a call. The thing we're going to in the UFO news today is the fact that the Mexicans say they found a couple alien bodies, blah, 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 blah. It's all bullshit, folks. It's bullshit. Jaime Maussan, this guy who does this TV show in Mexico City, he's full of shit. He always has been. And the really amazing thing is, and also I'm going to dovetail here into the press, and you know I hate the press. So Maussan's done this television show on Mexican television for like 20 years. It's a show about UFOs. It's on weekly. It's one of the highest rated shows on Mexican television. But he'll play anything. I mean, he advocates for everything. Shit that's obviously fake, he will advocate for. You know, that's his problem. It's not that he doesn't, that it's all bogus. No, he has some stuff on there. He's had some legitimate stuff. I'm sure that he has had that some of that video that he's broadcast the last 20 years is of legitimate UFOs. I would basically bet money on that. But he also has had a lot of crap. Now, this predates you. Around the year 2000, no one remembers this, but around the year 2000, the tabloid news industry in the United States, I'm talking about the National Enquirer, the Weekly World News, you know, what's another one? The Globe, all those supermarket rags were doing so poorly that the National Enquirer, the most circulated one, was thinking about shutting down. That's their business had basically completely gone to hell. And so they decided in a last-ditch attempt to try to, you know, do something different around the late 1990s, 97, 98, they decided they were going to get into real investigative journalism. None of this tabloid, entertainment, rumor, gossip, bullshit. They were going to get into real entertainment journalism. And one of the first things they did, and I don't know if you remember this, Frank Gifford, who's married to Kathy Lee Gifford, and who was the play-by-play guy in Monday Night Football, still to this day, one of the great play-by-play announcers in broadcasting period, that they basically coerced him into a hotel room with a flight attendant, and they filmed him having sex. So that was their idea of investigative journalism. But the thing is, it was true, you know? It's like he was having sex in that room with that woman, and they filmed it because they put up a two-way mirror. Okay. So, you know, Frank gets busted. Kathy Lee's beside herself. She doesn't know what to think. You know, they stay together, but whatever. But the fact is that that didn't save the publication. And the really weird thing is just around, you know, the internet, the commercial internet basically started. I've always pinned this as the defining moment, even though it isn't, and it was actually before this. But for all practical purposes, I define the start of the commercial internet in April 1995 when Yahoo moved from a Stanford University website URL to yahoo.com. That's what I define as the start of the commercial internet. Now, yes, there were commercial websites on before then. They were, and also should be, I guess that would be when July. Amazon was founded in, I think, June or July 94, even though they didn't have their website running up and running to July 96. But they things were starting then. And I remember there was the dominant search engine on the internet at that time was called WebCrawler. It was not very good, but there wasn't a lot to search either. And I don't know if you guys remember this. Yahoo was not a search engine. Yahoo was a directory of websites. So in April 1995, there were only about 400 or 500 websites, or at least commercial websites, on the entire internet. And so Yahoo dutifully registered all of them. They put together a directory by subject. And that grew and grew and grew until about the directory had about 25,000 websites in it. That was about 1997, I think it was. And then they got overwhelmed. But my point is, so the commercial internet started in early 96, 95. By 2000, when around 2000, so the stock market crashed in March of 2001, and that's when virtually all the commercial websites on the internet basically went out of business. I was running one of them. It was very large, and we went out of business. I'm not going to name it. We went out of business, too. So, Yahoo was one of the very few sites that survived that. Yahoo and Amazon, even though Amazon was still only selling books at that time. But at any rate, 2001 pretty much marks the beginning of the ascent of the internet. And the amazing thing is, so these stupid, rags, tabloid rags that almost went out of business, hit a nadir in 2000, 2001, started to climb back into popularity. They started to sell copies again because the internet basically whetted everybody's, appetite for cheap and tawdry gossip, which it still does. I mean, you know, my complaint of if you go to FoxNews.com, I think Fox News still, now I'm not going to make any comment right now on the actual opinions they're putting out there. That's a different matter. That's not what I'm talking about here. But as a broadcasting product, you basically can't do much better than that. You know, Roger Ailes, you know, you can call him a dirty and a pervert and all this sort of stuff, but he was also a broadcasting genius. And there's no way around that. And they're still riding on the coattails of what he did. And when he died about, 10 years ago now, I think it was something like that. I don't know. And he was, he was fired shortly before then. He died only a few months after he left Fox News. He actually fell down in his bathtub, if I'm right, and hit his head. And that started a brain hemorrhage, and that led to his death. Not right. It took a few weeks, but that's how he passed away. But there's, it's a excellent broadcast product. But the website, Jesus, I don't know. It's like they publish so much gossip shit, and the thing is, they know who their target market is. It's mostly older men. They know that, so they run all these pervy swimsuit shit. Crap, I love looking at girls in swimsuits. I do. I don't want to see it on a news site. I just don't. I don't care for their website leaves much to be desired, especially when compared to the television, the broadcast cable product. When I want to point this out again too, people don't understand this. If you watch Fox News and every once in a while they brag about their viewership, that's actually an understatement. They're beating the shit out of everybody still. Fox News is not only the best, highest rated news cable channel, it's the highest rated channel on all of cable television, period. It now way eclipses even ESPN. It's there's no way around it. And then you look at the fact that Gutfeld is doing his show now they moved it to 10 o'clock Eastern instead of 11. So, but he's competing against Jimmy Fallon and Stephen Colbert, and he's beating all of them. He pretty much ties with Colbert, but not lately because these shows, because of the strike, are off the air. Basically, they're running reruns. So right now, Gutfeld's cleaning up because Gutfeld is not running reruns. They're doing new shows. So, but the thing is, you have to understand, it's paid television. You have to pay to see it. And he's still beating the crap out of those guys. It's like, it's really freaking amazing, you know? Now, those people, that group of left-wing comedians who host those late-night talk shows, and there's about five of them, basically. I'm not going to include Real Time with Bill Maher in this because that's a weekly show. That's kind of a different deal. That is also on paid television too, so that's worth noting. I think Maher's a good egg. I don't agree with him on a lot of stuff, but I'd have no trouble talking to him. I'd love to have him come on and interview him. You know, it's really interesting. I can sit here and bash liberals, but there's some liberals, and I've always said this too. This is my thing. Like, 80% of the Democratic Party is really just fine. I mean, I may disagree with them, but I don't have any problem with them. You know, it's the 20% of the Democratic Party is made up now of complete, utter, crazy lunatics, and somehow they have taken over the whole party. And Mars talked about this too. He's mentioned the same thing. I mean, I look at Marr as a traditional classic liberal. Now, Marr hates Donald Trump's guts. Okay, a lot of people do. I have Republican friends who hate Donald Trump's guts. So that's not a, unusual. I just put my finger in my ear. I'm not going to use that as a deal breaker or as a criteria here. But I mean, he said the same thing. The Democratic Party is now controlled by these lunatics. But a lot of people I'd love to talk to. I would have no trouble interviewing Rachel Maddow. No trouble at all. I don't agree with her on hardly anything, but still, you know, she's a reasonable person. She's described herself as an Eisenhower Republican, which is kind of how I would describe myself too. I mean, we might have more in common than I even know, you know? So, and there's a lot of people like that, but you know, you look at AOC, the squad is nuts, you know? Ilhan Omar, the woman who actually is a representative for the district I'm sitting in this very second while I'm talking to you, she's crazy. She's crazy out of her mind crazy. She's an anti-Semitic woman who can't figure out who she's married to and apparently married her brother. And also there's been rumors floating around here in town for years that she pays people to vote for her. $200 as it gets what the pop is. These people, you know, this is just out of control. All right, hold on a second. I want to pull up something here. Let me give you an example. Okay, so MSNBC columnist Dean Obadiah, he went on MSNBC yesterday and said that to protect the Republic, Donald Trump must die in prison. And this is a quote. He said he believes this with every fiber of being, quote, I don't care if he was 45 years old. You should get a life in prison if you just attempt a coup, and there should be no chance for parole. Okay, do I have to point out to these people? I do. That Donald Trump did not instigate a coup, he wasn't part of one. So he got up that day at that rally and said, we are now going to peacefully and patriotically go to the Capitol. And then he left. And I've been saying this, you know, since this happened, that none of the people in the Democratic Party understand this. Well, I think actually they do. They don't want to admit it because then they have to give up the boogeyman. If Donald Trump hadn't have been there, the same thing would have happened. This had nothing to do with Trump at all. And then on top of that, the proof of the fact that he was not involved in an insurrection, 2 days before that rally, he offered to provide the National Guard as safety for the rally and the Capitol. And Nancy Pelosi and the police and the head of the police chief for D.C. refused. So you're going to tell me that guy's trying to pull an insurrection? The thing is, if he truly did, they would have... All these indictments, they would have busted him on this big time if they thought they could. They can't. He was not involved in an insurrection. All right, so Murray Sabrin's here. We're going to talk to him. I'm going to run our short little bumper here thingy now, and when we come back, Murray will be with us. Here we go. Murray,
good to be with you, Jim.
How you doing?
Great.
You look fantastic. I got a new intro, Murray. You want me to play it for you?
Absolutely.
Oh, here you go. See, Murray, I can't talk for you, but that sexually excites me. You know, coming to your cordless, yeah. All right, so first question, Murray, and I know in emails I asked you about this. You've been in Fort Myers, Florida now for what, 2 years?
Well, actually, we're now in Naples. It's almost a year now we're in Naples.
I always get this confused. Now when you're in Naples, you were in Fort Myers, right? Correct. You've been in Florida for, what, 2 to 3 years, right?
Just over 2 years. We came here June of 21.
And so far, you've gone through 3 hurricanes, right?
Well, actually, just the big one in Fort Myers in at the end of September. So it's a nearly a year anniversary when the hurricane came through. Unfortunately, my sister-in-law was living on Sanibel at the time, and the whole island got devastated. She left the day before with the 3 puppies, and she's now living in the Fort Myers area. But it was devastating, Fort Myers.
She never went back?
No. The house had to be gutted because there was so much water in the house. The mold.
Oh, God.
Everything was taken out. We never saw it, but it was a devastating hurricane. It was one of those, they say, 1 in 100 year hurricanes that came through with the wind and the rain, obviously, and people who didn't leave, unfortunately, some of them passed away, and those that did leave, many of them lost everything in the hurricane, especially the ones that were close to the shore. Those are the people at Fort Myers Beach. If you see the pictures of Fort Myers Beach, you probably Google it and see a time-lapse video of the water coming in, and it was just unbelievable. We were watching it. And it's hard to believe that so close to where we were living, we were far away from the shore, and to see an area just get so inundated with water. And this is the hazard of living near the coastline, no matter where you are in the country, whether it's the Northeast, the Southeast, the yeah. West, the Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi area. And of course, people still build there, which is really amazing when you think about it. And that's why insurance costs are so high, because insurance companies have to charge a lot. And when there's a hurricane, the rates get jacked up in order to make the insurance companies profitable. And well, so my this incredible was, moral hazard, because sometimes the government underwrites the flood insurance.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. My account explained to me that up till, I think they've rescinded it now or suspended it, but for many years you could get like federal flood hurricane insurance for like $100 a year, right?
I don't know how much it was, but it shows you how incentives affect people's behavior.
Yeah, for sure.
And flood insurance is probably the best example of that, because if you had private insurance and the rates would have to be so high, very few people could afford it, then you wouldn't have the overbuilding at the shore areas, like we have in New Jersey, like you have in Florida and other places around the country.
Yeah, but I think if I'm right, my accountant said that no longer exists. Like a year or two ago, they finally stopped that or something. Am I right about that? Do you know?
I don't know, because it's not something I had to investigate for where we were living. So it's an area that I don't have much information at my fingertips.
I tell you what, you just brought on an interesting idea here. Let's talk about something you and I normally don't talk about, because you just brought up the idea of incentive. So yeah. There's crimes going rampant across the country because all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of DAs who have decided there's a whole bunch of stuff that isn't crime. Isn't that just incentivizing criminals?
No question about it. I mean, this is why economics is a very important subject, because it helps explain a lot of social phenomena. In fact, there was one criminologist, I think James Wilson, who explained why criminals are different from the rest of us, because they're very high time preference. What does that mean? In a person that is not a criminal, high time preference means they shop till they drop. They spend everything that they earn because they just have to get a hold of every new gadget that's out there, clothes, jewelry, cars, whatever. And so they don't save any money, or they save very little. Criminals are high time preference because they don't have the skills in order to earn money. So what do? They use aggressive behavior to obtain the things they want, either burglary, robbery, smash and grab, carjacking, cyber theft, and what have you. And that was just a brilliant explanation of why criminals are much different than the rest of us, because they have this economic outlook on the world that I want something, and if I can't get it peacefully, I'll do it through aggressive behavior.
And also, just like you pointed out, oh, Jesus, They got to shoot me and put me in the back. Just take me to the back of the barn and just put me down. Okay. All right. What am I talking about here? I'm talking about the fact that these criminals, for all practical purposes, this is their profession. You know, that's the thing. I mean, it's like, yeah, you named off, smash and grab, cyber theft, robberies, burglaries, all this sort of stuff. You basically end up doing this as a vocation.
Yeah.
And that's how you make money. And so if we're not going to arrest people for doing this shit, why should they stop?
They won't. That's the whole problem. They won't. And to have DAs or the state of California say that theft under $900 is not prosecutable is just insanity.
It is.
It just shows you how our Judeo-Christian culture has gone down the tubes. I mean, don't young kids learn thou shalt not steal either in Sunday school or Hebrew school or other religious institution they go to? And that's something I learned as a youngster, the Ten Commandments. And if you live by the Ten Commandments, Jim, you wouldn't need police, you wouldn't need prisons, you wouldn't need anything, divorce courts, what have you. And so This is why culture is so important. If you understand the culture, you can really explain what's going on in society. And today, you have a lot of things that can be explained by the lack of ethical and moral perspective that people have.
I'm at a party in 1996, and I'm talking to a guy who just retired as a Methodist minister. And we started talking about Christianity. And I don't know how we got on the subject, but he said something that I thought was very prescient. He said, and I don't know where, you know, and he showed me his hand here. He said, you know, it doesn't really matter if Jesus Christ rose from the dead or not. What matters is what he taught. And and the thing, I remember that because I'm thinking, you know, if you look back on Christianity and the teachings of like the Ten Commandments, doing the others, you know, all sorts of what Jesus taught, it's almost radical in its simplity. You know, it's like I don't care if you're Christian or not, or if you buy the fact that Jesus rose from the dead, if you follow this stuff, you're going to do okay, you know?
Well, not only the golden rule, but what about live and let live? I mean, if we have live and let live, you wouldn't have these endless wars that we've had around the world for centuries.
Yeah, especially the endless wars that seems like get propagated so people can make money. There's no way around it, you know?
It's all about following the money. And this is why another great insight, I think it was Franz Oppenheimer, the German sociologist, that there are two ways of acquiring wealth, the political means and the economic means. The economic means is voluntary exchange, the free market. And the political means is either through crime or the government taking your money and giving it to somebody else. So life is pretty easily understood if you have some basic principles to guide your thinking about how to explain people's behavior.
Yeah. Hey, Murray, I don't think I've ever asked you point blank. So what do you think of the Ukraine war and our involvement in it?
For those of us that grew up during the Vietnam War, that was a disaster. Then we had the two Mideast wars. And this is not our fight. This is a dispute between Russia and Ukraine. And all the evidence, Jim, from people who were there making policy to analysts today, when the Soviet Union fell apart, when East Europe was liberated and the Warsaw Pact was dissolved by the Soviet Union, the United States told Gorbachev that NATO would not expand one inch to the east. And what happened? NATO started expanding eastward to Poland, to the Baltic nations, to other countries. And Russia has national security interests just as we do. And so they certainly don't want Ukraine part of NATO, because then you would have missiles in Ukraine very close to Moscow, just as you have missiles, I guess, in Poland also. So this is another example of U.S. foreign policy, which has been a total disaster. People will say since World War II, but some people will say since the Spanish-American War, where we got involved in a war with Spain, and that gave us colonies in the Philippines. We still own Puerto Rico. The United States still controls Puerto Rico, and the Philippines became independent, as you know, after World War II. So this is an example of explaining war. And the best monograph that was written 40 years ago about this is Murray Rothbard's Wall Street, Banks, and U.S. Foreign Policy, which you can people can read it free on the Mises.org website, Mises.org. And I first read it 40 years ago when it came out. And he shows the relationship between Wall Street, the State Department, and U.S. foreign policy. It's just a brilliant analysis of how U.S. foreign policy has evolved in the post-war period.
When did he write this?
It was published in 1984, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't known what to think of the Ukraine war, because on the one hand, we get to fight our enemy basically by proxy. We haven't lost a single person in this war so far, you know. But on the other hand, I just wonder if this is another grind to get more money out of the American public to fund a bunch of defense contractors. And not to mention the fact that, and even basically Lazinski admits this at this point, Ukraine is still one of the most corrupt governments on the planet. We're propping up this complete bullshit of a government, you know, and then for what, you know?
And not only that, the United States engineered a coup against the democratically elected government in Ukraine in 2014. So the United States doesn't have any clean hands when it comes to democracy, when a democratically elected government was overthrown by the United States. And the United States has a habit of overthrowing. September 11th, which we don't celebrate, we commemorate it with what happened on September 11th with the attacks. But it's also the 50th anniversary of the United States helping to overthrow Allende in Chile. So the United States has been actively involved. And one of the books that talks about this, a more recent book, is Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. And he shows how young college students and graduates are recruited by the intelligence agencies to become part of the national intelligence apparatus and go overseas and gather data and get their hooks into other governments. It's just a very good, insightful book by somebody who was there.
We got to put a link to that on our blog. I'll remember to do that.
Yeah, it's an incredible book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I mean, it's just a riveting book. The other book that I read back, I think 40 years ago also, was The Invisible Government by David Weiss. And he points out that we have a permanent government in place. Presidents come and go, as we know. Members of Congress come and go, but there's a permanent government in Washington, the CIA.
When was that written again?
David Weiss, The Invisible Government.
When was that written?
I think it was published in the early 80s.
Oh, he was way ahead of his time, man.
Oh, yeah. Like, there are a whole bunch of books out there like that. G. William Domhoff, The Higher Circles and Who Rules America. These books that go back decades by people from different disciplines, some people on the left, some people on the right, but they all have this focus on who is really making policy. If anyone thinks that Joe Biden is making policy, I have a bridge to sell them in New York City. I mean, Joe Biden is not making policy. He's the perfect puppet candidate that we've had in the United States.
Yeah, but What do you do about this bureaucracy, this bureaucratic state? And the thing is, it just grows and grows. And this is kind of to one of our talking points today, and that is, it has not been advertised, but from what I understand, all the supposed uptick in employment in the United States, the biggest single sector of employment is the federal government.
Yeah.
And nobody really talks about that.
Well, not only that, you have the debt, you have the inflation, you have, which I wrote about today, my Substack column, I wrote a piece on the CPI, and then tomorrow the producer price index comes out, I'll be writing about that, and so there's a lot to write about. So people...
About the CPI, so there's another thing I want to talk to you about too, and this hasn't really made the news either, and this is the shit I like to talk about, the stuff that really people don't really hear about. Supposedly, since Biden took the office, in the last 30 months... every single economic indicator that's come out by the government, like at the first of the month, the standard like unemployment figures and all the figures they generally put out, supposedly they've all been not only refined downward in subsequent months, and not only sometimes 2 or 3 months later, not even the second, you know, 1 month later, but every single, it's happened every single month that they've been basically They've been, and if you take those adjustments into consideration, the economy is really way worse than it actually is. Have you heard about this, or have you looked at this? Or
the employment numbers that came out in the first Friday of September, that the unemployment numbers, employment numbers come out, and the first Friday of each month, reported by the Labor Department, they have revisions constantly, and they revised, I think, 2 months ago, downward quite a bit in terms of the number of new hires. So again, government data are basically sampling data. Most people don't know that. They're not taking an actual headcount of unemployment and employment. It's a survey, and they use some statistical methods to extrapolate to the whole society. And that's why ADP, automatic data processing, that used to be called, they do a survey of businesses to get a handle on what they think is happening in the economy regarding the employment situation. But there's so many things wrong with government data. We could spend days talking about all the different time series, but I go to the Federal Reserve of St. Louis website, and it's called FRED, the Federal Reserve Economic Database, and they have tons and tons of time series of all the things that are either reported or not reported, but they're there where people like me can do research and see exactly how the economy is unfolding over time. And right now, it looks like, Jim, my forecast of December 2021 in Fortune magazine, as I forecast that the economy was going into recession in the second half of 2023. Here we are in the second half of 2023, and last month the unemployment rate ticked up. If it continues to tick up month after month after month, it means that the recession is finally here, which is not a surprise since the Federal Reserve pumped so much money in during COVID in 2020, and that money has given us the inflation since then. So it's not the Biden inflation, although it's happening under the Biden administration. It's the Federal Reserve's inflation, because they're the ones that have the ability to create money. And that money, it goes through the banking system, which then gets dispersed as loans. Those loans show up in the real estate market and in stock prices, bond prices, other prices in the economy. And now we're seeing wages trying to keep up. And that's why UPS workers got a very hefty raise. The UAW is trying to get a big raise from the auto manufacturers. And other workers are trying to get big raises to make up for the inflation, the loss of purchasing power the last 3 years. So people talk about the wage price spiral. No, it's really the price wage spiral, because as prices go up and union contracts are locked in over 3, 4, 5 years, the workers get shafted. That's the only way you can describe it, because their purchasing power is going down, prices are going up, and they're really feeling the pinch of higher inflation.
Shit, Murray, are prices going up? I do the grocery shopping for my family. So I'm in the grocery store this afternoon. I like Campbell's Chunky Soup. For years, it's been about $1.79, right? A can.
Yeah.
Now today on sale for $2.50.
Yep.
Just out of nowhere. I mean, I have seen prices at the grocery store basically for some items basically double in the last 9 months, and they're trying to tell me that everything's good. This is it's the gaslighting campaign that I just find unbelievably brazen. It's like
Well, the thing is, I did a somewhat of a deep dive into the CPI report that was published today by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So you go to their website, bls.gov, and if you read my Substack article, I have links to the to where you can find the data. And gasoline prices skyrocketed last month. It was up 10.5%. I mean, a huge jump in 1 month. From a year ago, automobile insurance costs have up 19%. So these are things that people pay on a regular basis, things are skyrocketing. Food prices have been going up. Airline fares have been going down, interestingly enough. That's one thing. And there was an anomaly. It showed that medical insurance costs are down 33% from a year ago. I don't think so. So there's something really screwy going on with how they're calculating medical insurance prices, because there's no way that medical insurance premiums are down 33% from a year ago. That just doesn't make any sense. So
do you ever think there's any corruption in this actual data or survey?
No, I think it's just a methodology. John Williams has been a long time economic analyst. He has a website called Shadow Stats, and he shows the current CPI numbers. Then he shows what the CPI numbers would be if we use the methodology from 40 years ago. And he shows that the inflation rate is at least double, if not triple, than what's being reported by the government. So they constantly massage the data and use different methodologies to come up with what they consider a more realistic approach to prices and the employment situation. But again, the old adage is, when your neighbor is out of work, it's a recession. When you're out of work, it's a depression. So if people are working, but their prices are going up, at least they have the ability to eke out a living. And we know 60% of the American people are living paycheck to paycheck, which is an incredible indictment of our economy and public policy, because in a, quote, normal economy, people should be saving a good portion of their income and not having to live paycheck to paycheck. And we know that so many people are dependent solely on Social Security for their retirement income. When the Social Security Administration says on their website, Social Security is one third of what should be your retirement income. You should have a pension or a 401k, and you should have savings as well. But so many people have just Social Security because taxes and prices have been so high for the last 40, 50, 60 years, people have not been able to save enough money for their own retirement. And in today's Wall Street Journal, to bring things home to where I'm living here in Naples, there's now a growing homeless problem here in Naples, Florida, because prices for rentals have gone through the roof. And it's just an amazing article right on the front page of how baby boomers, our generation, Jim, the number of homeless is increasing among baby boomers. And we're the generation that supposedly was going to be taken care of well in our retirement because of Social Security savings and investments. But
Murray, as far as you can tell, is the homeless problem way worse today than it was 20 years ago, or is it just more evident? Is it just more visible?
I think it's more visible. Again, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, and it's hard to really get a good handle as to how much homeless there are. I don't know how you do a census on that figure, but you look what's going on in New York City with the migrant population from the southern border coming in. New York City has taken in 100,000 migrants the last couple of years or so, and the streets are teeming in Midtown Manhattan with migrants. I mean, it's New York City and other big cities are looking like third world cities, and I've seen third world cities because we traveled a lot before I retired. And I can tell you, New York City, from the pictures I've seen in the paper on the newscast, it's unrecognizable to people who haven't been there for a while. And commercial real estate is in the doldrums, to say the least. And those buildings will be converted eventually into either retail space or housing, because there's a definite demand for housing in New York City. And it's happening in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other big cities. So the Biden administration has given us this migrant crisis. At least 7 million people are coming through the southern border. Now they're coming in through the northern border from Canada. Yeah. And this is a disgraceful aspect of Biden's policy. Yeah. I'm an immigrant. All my parents' friends, immigrants from World War II, we came here following the rules that were in place after World War II, and we were welcomed. We moved to the Lower East Side, as many immigrants did after World War II, or the Brooklyn in New York City, and they built lives for themselves. They didn't expect any handouts from the city government. The men got jobs. The women stayed at home raising the kids. And occasionally they'd work part-time, and you had an orderly progression of immigrants in the 1940s and 50s and so on and so forth. And then this whole thing became out of whack with so-called immigration reform in the 60s and other laws that were put into place. And then Reagan's amnesty in 1986, which supposedly fixed the problem, but it apparently made things worse. And now you have no immigration policy. You have just the southern border wide open. We have no idea if people are coming in with any ability to earn a living here, whether they're healthy or not. They're putting huge pressure on the healthcare system, on the school system with the kids, and between the sex trafficking and other things that are going on in the southern border. This is a nightmare for anyone who's living in the southern tier of the country and in the big cities where migrants are arriving. And so if the government doesn't get a good handle on it, and unfortunately the government is heavily involved in this, and we know when government gets involved in something, it messes things up completely. And so we need to have more social service agencies handling this, but you have to have government policy where people wait in line like we did in 1949. My father got the papers that we needed to come to America, and that's the way we did it. And so why that policy is not in effect today just shows you the change in culture and philosophy in Washington, D.C., that anything goes. I mean, I'm all for laissez-faire economy, but I think a laissez-faire immigration policy has turned into a nightmare for
Washington. Mary, I'm not the only person who thinks this, but I'm paranoid. You know, at this point, I just assume what they're doing is deliberate. I think it's first of all, you said, 7 million people have come in. That's about 2% of the American population.
Yeah.
I think they're letting these people in because at some point they figure they'll be able to either covertly or actually through legislation give them the right to vote. And they'll almost all vote Democrat because they'll remember who let them in. And 2% right now can swing an election. I think, I don't know.
Well, my proposal is pretty simple, Jim. If you don't come here illegally, you cannot be a U.S. citizen. You can only be a permanent resident.
Yeah.
You're deported automatically.
But you make sense.
Common sense is a very scarce commodity in Washington, D.C.
No, it is. Absolutely. And not only that, with a media culture we have right now, it seems like there's an incentive to actually be outrageous because it's the only way you can get any attention.
Yeah.
You know, now if you follow the story, I'm kind of getting off the track here, but still, but the point is made of this woman in New Mexico who's running for the congressional seat, I think it is, who got busted, I guess busted, posting porn, making porn with her husband online.
It was, it was Virginia for a
Virginia. Okay.
Seat
thank you.
In the House of Delegates. Yeah. I mean, it's just the culture has been really devalued. There's no question about it. I mean,
yeah.
I grew up in the 60s during the height of the Vietnam War when drug use became very common among young people. I, of course, did not smoke. I took a puff of cigarettes when I was 15 and I said, this is not for me. So and I had no desire to drink or to smoke. And so that was my outlook on life. But people do crazy things, really crazy stuff.
Well, the real crazy thing in this particular instance is that she is blaming the press for making a big deal out of this. She says unearthing these videos is a sex crime, and yet she did this in public. There's no logic to what she's talking about whatsoever, but it gets her on, on the news. So I don't know. Trade-off.
Let's see if she gets so. First of all, she's in a primary, so let's see if she wins the primary. If she does, whether she wins the general election, but it just shows you how the culture has been degraded. I think when you have young kids going to these transgender and drag shows, I mean, where are these parents' heads? What do they think they're doing for their kids? By
I don't know.
It makes no sense to me, and the schools. Basically not having the word that I like to use is decorum. I grew up in an age when decorum was part of your public persona, that you would do things in public that would not be embarrassing to anybody or shameful. And yet today people do shameful things in public and think that that's the norm. And again, it just shows you how our culture has dramatically changed in the last 30, 40, 50 years.
There's a guy I've been trying to get on to interview. I think I've succeeded. We'll see. His name is John J. Miller. He wrote a book about, I think, in 1998. And if I'm right, the book is entitled, this is not what I was going to interview about, but I found it interesting. The book's entitled The Unmaking of the Americans. And his point in this book, and like, now you are an actual immigrant. I'm a first generation American. My parents both came here. And I've always said this, and we've talked about this before, about the fact that when my parents, and specifically my dad, has stories about this, when they came over to the United States, like the idea was to become an American. Mm-hmm. That's You know, he wanted to be an American. He had stories about going to buy his first suit and all sorts of stuff like this, you know. And so the idea was to assimilate into the culture. The Mr. Miller's, the point of Mr. Miller's book is that now the immigrants who come to the United States, it seems like it's the opposite. Their idea is to actually turn the United States into the culture they left. And because of that, we have no assimilation at all.
Well, 4 years ago, almost exactly 4 years ago, I gave my farewell address at Ramapo College several months before I retired in July of 2020. And I predicted, the title of my talk was America the Next 70 Years. And you can see it online at the Ramapo College website. Just Google in America the Next 70 Years. And I predicted that America will not survive as a nation in the next 70 years because there are too many cultural differences that have emerged in America. I mean, the culture down in the South where I'm living now is a lot different than Northeast on a whole host of issues, even though we're starting to see more Northerners come down here, and some of them are left-wing Democrats. And so they bring those ideas down here. But still, it's a fairly conservative state here in Florida. DeSantis won an overwhelming victory for governor last November. But even the whole, you go into the store, you have a different feeling than up north. There's more courtesy in the stores than you have up north to a large extent. It's just a much more laid back culture down here and atmosphere. And California, we know, is a lot different than the rest of the country. The Midwest is a lot different. The Northwest is a lot different. I could see America by the end of this century, if not sooner, breaking up into several countries or having, ironically, like the Articles of Confederation, where like the Swiss Canton system, where the regions would have more power than the federal government. The federal government would basically be for national defense, and everything else would be more decentralized. And I think that's where we're headed, because the one way to stop the polarization in the country is live and let live, which means that if you want to have certain books in the library, then you form a co-op and put together a library that you want to have these books. If you don't want to patronize that library, you have a library that has other books more suitable for children. So you can do everything that people want as long as you decentralize. But once you have a centralizing authority, that's when the conflict arises, because people have different values. So how do you address different value systems in a nation of 340 million people? You have to decentralize. And that's the message that I'm trying to get out to as many people as possible. And other people are trying to get out, because decentralization works. It's the best tonic for polarization at the national level.
And yet, you know, it's true in it's true in every single basically human enterprise. Anything, the more you decentralize, the better things run. But there's people who think you have to control stuff. I mean, this is my big thing about Adam Smith and the Invisible Hand. That definitely works. That's definitely a concept. But a lot of people just can't buy it. So, like, what do you mean? You mean nobody controls anything and everything runs okay? Yeah, that's what happens. You know, but a lot of people can't wrap their minds around that. They think somebody's got to control everything.
Well, you know why, Jim? Because since the New Deal, the federal government has been involved in everything for 90 years now. It's 90 years since Roosevelt got elected. It's 1932 to 2022. That's 90 years. Yeah. What have we had? More and more control by Washington, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all these aid to dependent children. All these programs began in the 1930s and just have spiraled out of control. That's why we have a $32 trillion debt and nearly a $7 trillion budget. If we had a decentralized economy since the New Deal, the federal budget would be a fraction of what it is today. You wouldn't have Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Everything would be done at the individual, family, and community level. And that's the way you have a vibrant, and I'm going to use the word deliberately, diversified economy with no conflict.
And so tell me if I get my figures right here. The income tax, federal income tax, was instituted in 1902 or 1903.
Well, the 16th Amendment was passed in 1913, and the first income tax was collected in 1914.
Okay. All right. So I know at that time when that happened, everybody said, oh, this is the road to hell. It's a slippery slope. And if I'm correct, the first original, that year, first year, federal income tax was 2%, I think, something like that.
It went from 1% to 7%. And 98% of the people, Jim, didn't pay the income tax, because the income tax was only kicked in after $4,000 in income for a couple. And most people didn't earn $4,000 in 1914. So again, it shows you what happened with the income tax. And then,
yeah, well, you told me this because I had this figure wrong one of the times we talked previously. And that is, you fast forward to 1960 and the high tax rate, the highest tax rate was 92%.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
crazy shit. It yeah. went from 2% to 92% in what, 50 years? That's
but,
nuts.
Yeah, yeah, but you had to have such a high income for that. But
I know.
Still, people didn't pay those rates because you had a lot of deductions back then.
Yeah.
So many things were deductible. And the biggest achievement of the Reagan administration was that we got the rates down to 15 and 28. We only had two rates. And then the rates started going back up. And now I think we have 6 or 7 rates. So
right.
The income tax has been a social engineering tool rather than just a way to raise revenue. And it's the worst way to raise revenue because as the critics of the income tax back in the early debates in the early 1900s said, this is going to lead to more invasion of our financial information and privacy. And that's exactly what's happened.
They
and
were now, right. Totally.
The Biden administration is hiring 87,000 new IRS agents. So if you're going to have an income tax, it should be a flat tax at a very low rate. And this way you could fill it out on a form. But as I written in my first book on tax-free 2000, we don't need an income tax. Florida doesn't have an income tax. Nevada doesn't have an income tax. Tennessee doesn't have an income tax. So Texas doesn't have an income tax. Here are two large states with over 20 million people. They don't have an income tax and they collect enough revenue to do the things that government is trying to do without an income tax. And yet New York City, New York State have income taxes and their economic basket cases.
Murray, the at least on the state level, if not federal, the government does obviously need a certain amount of money to run, to build roads, bridges, all this sure. sort of stuff. So if you don't have an income tax, how does the government make money?
Well, the thing is, you have the gas tax, which is not a tax; it's a user fee.
It's a fee, right?
It's a fee for using the roads. I have no problem with that. The big
right.
thing is, you have Social Security taxes, you have Medicare taxes, you have all these other things. What drives taxes is all the spending. So, if the government is going to commit to spend money on all these programs that have grown since 1914. Through the New Deal, the Great Society programs, and from then on, you've got to raise a lot of money. And of course, the government doesn't raise enough money to pay its bills. That's why it's been borrowing trillions of dollars over the last 40 years. And
right.
when Reagan became president in 1981, winning the election in 1980, I think the national debt was $1 trillion. Now it's $32 trillion. Because anyone
yeah.
say that the economy is 32 times better because of all this debt? No, of course not. All it does, it's sucking resources away from the financial markets, which means that there isn't enough capital for entrepreneurs and businesses to get the capital they need to make life better for us through a process called capital formation, a course that was in the business school when I taught at finance at Rand Poe College. One of my colleagues taught that. Capital formation is the key to prosperity, Jim. Without capital formation, we can't communicate on a laptop or a computer. We can't communicate with a cell phone. We can't drive a car because you need plants to build all this stuff, the semiconductors and all the other things that go into these high-tech gadgets. I mean, most economists either ignore capital formation or they think that consumption is the key to the economy. Because you see this on CNBC and other financial shows. Consumption is 70% of the economy. Okay, but that's an accounting mechanism. But what drives that consumption is production. As I explained to my students, I can't be a consumer as a college professor unless I first teach and get a paycheck so I can consume. I can't consume out of thin air. I have to produce something. And I produce educational services.
Okay, so years. I just look at that and I think, well, isn't that just master of the obvious shit? I mean,
yeah.
You don't need to be a rocket scientist to understand that, do you?
No,
now, the
not.
Interesting thing, Murray, I read a lot of stuff. Of course I do, you know, and I'm starting to see the last couple weeks now, I'm starting to see people kind of alluding to what you were talking about the fact that maybe we're heading for a huge recession, about the fact that underlying data is not, the things are not going well. You know, this is what I'm starting to see right now. You said something that I just made. Now I can't remember what I was going to say, but Yeah, because that's my problem, Murray.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, really. Okay, so yeah, I was gonna make, you said something that made me think of something. Okay, and all right. Well, we'll just skip it. I'm just boring people now.
When I had my own talk show host in the mid '90s in New Jersey, I always had a notepad with what I wanted to interview the guest with. When you have guests that you're on for a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour, it just went so seamlessly because I grew up listening to talk radio during the 1960s. And when a new station came in northern New Jersey, I went to the station and said, I'd like to do a show about the economy, about politics, whatever. And they initially gave me 3 hours and eventually it was an hour. Then I ran for governor in 97, so I went off the air. But I love talk radio because now we have podcasts. It's a great way to communicate ideas to people and let them think about what people are saying about different aspects of the economy and the politics.
Murray, I do have an outline here. I do actually have notes, but the thing is, I try to react to what people say.
Sure.
So that's and sometimes it doesn't work. So, all right. So you're still sticking to your prediction that by the middle of next year, we're going to have to see some dire shit, huh?
Yeah. Well, I think we're starting to see the beginning of what is happening in a lot of companies are announcing layoffs. It's under the radar screen, but you can see this on CNBC's website, that sometimes the Wall Street Journal will have companies that are laying off, especially in the high tech area, because these are the areas that expanded during COVID because of people staying at home and not going to work or not going to school. And so companies hired a lot of employees to make sure that platforms were working and other services related to communications were doing well. Now people are going back to the office. So you're seeing companies laying off excess workers. And we're seeing retailers are laying off people as well because a lot of companies are finding their profit margins are down quite a bit as their costs go up and people are not buying as much as they otherwise would. So there's a lot of mixed signals in the economy today. But the key thing I watch is the unemployment rate, because that really is historically, when that starts increasing, that means that companies are really getting serious about getting their costs under control.
Uh-huh. Okay, so now you said something about 15 minutes ago that I want to get back to before we leave here. And that is, you were talking, just I made an offhand comment about the commercial real estate market.
Yeah.
So, all right. So the thing about COVID is that COVID basically accelerated something that was probably going to happen anyway. And that is, remote work. Zoom happened to be standing in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. And all people realize, oh, there's a software. I don't need to actually go into the office. Yeah. So now people do not want to go to the office because they realize they can work and do their laundry at the same time.
Yep.
But you have all these, and especially in large cities, you have all these skyscrapers with offices that now are having a hard time filling with what's going to happen here. I mean, is there any chance that the commercial real estate market will collapse?
I wouldn't say collapse, but I think a lot of there are different tiers, A buildings, B buildings, C buildings, and the A buildings will probably do well because you have a lot of major corporations that are in the top tier office buildings. It's probably the B and C buildings that are not in the downtown area that may have marginal companies in them and who don't want to sign long-term leases anymore. Those leases may be coming due in the next year or two or three. So, and plus they may have to roll over their debt. Mortgage rates, we know, have gone up. So if they had a 5-year mortgage that's coming due soon, and they've got to roll it over at much higher interest rate, that could be a problem for a lot of the developers and owners out there. So we're gonna see defaults. There's no question about it, because there's been distortions created by COVID and the Federal Reserve's easy money policies, and all this is coming together in a recession that could be started already. We just don't know until after the fact. So yeah, as the monthly data come out, I'll be writing on Substack what it looks like in terms of the economy. But again, there's always opportunity in a recession because prices tend to go down, especially in items that were inflated during the boom. And that's when a lot of people buy up assets, companies that are flush with cash, like Berkshire Hathaway's got, I don't know, $150 billion in cash. And Buffett is always looking for strategic investments because they've gone down so much in price, whether it's stocks or companies that are looking for a private company that may be looking for the owner may want to cash out now because the children may not don't want to take over the business or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, Murray, I'm not a big student of investing, but this Buffett guy pretty much did. He cleaned up just by sticking to basic shit, didn't he?
Oh yeah, what do people need, and what companies are out there that I can buy at a fair price. That's what he's always looking for, at a fair price. He doesn't like to overpay for companies, even though he's made some bonehead mistakes. He admits he bought a shoe company with stock that turned out to be a bust. I think the company went under, and he issued a lot of stock that's worth a fortune to the shareholders of the company or the owners of the shoe company that he bought. He bought airline stocks that didn't work out well. Airline, as you know, is a tough business to make a profit. So he admits he's made mistakes over the years. But the beauty thing about Berkshire Hathaway is the company has grown and grown and grown over the last 60 years since he's controlled it. He's become a multi-billionaire, and there are people who have become very wealthy by owning the stock over a long period of time.
Well, you can't be involved in anything that deep and not make mistakes. It's as simple as that. You know, it's just going to happen. The only real question is, what's your batting average, you know? So you know what occurred to me today, Murray? I was working at my desk, and I realized that we don't link to your Substack feed, and I thought I made a point to tonight, tomorrow, I will link put a link in our blog to your Substack feed so people can read it and sign up.
Terrific.
You have a lot of cool stuff going on there.
Yeah. So, also, if you could link to my memoir, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual.
Oh, you've already done that, you know. That link's still up.
That's great. If I had to do a new title, I would call it From Liberalism to Libertarianism, An Immigrant's Journey in America.
Oh, that's interesting. That has a nice little alliterative ring to it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never asked you this before. You're a former liberal, because I am, too?
Well, I first cast my vote in 1968 for Hubert Humphrey and for president. And I was doing an analysis the night of the election, I think, or the day before the election. And I said, there's no way, given the I was reading Newsweek magazine, and they went through state by state. And I said, there's no way that Humphrey's going to win the election. And, of course, Nixon won. And won a landslide in 72, and then 2 years later, he resigns because of the Watergate scandal. So politics is a very, very fluid thing, as we've seen, because you could have a landslide election like Reagan had in 84, Nixon in 72, and yet the Democrats come back and win, just as Jimmy Carter won in 76, and then Bill Clinton wins in 92. After Reagan and Bush were in, and Bush was such a terrible president, but he had to contend with H. Ross Perot, who got 19% of the vote, so that really hurt his reelection chances.
And we should wrap this up, but I still got to ask you about this. I want to ask you about Jimmy Carter. Here's a guy who should have been a great president.
Yeah,
I mean, he had all the earmarks. So first of all, he was an entrepreneur. I mean, people don't realize this. I think this is still true. I'm not sure that Carter Farms is still the major producer of peanuts in the United States. I know it was true when he ran for office. I know that. So he had a big, huge business. He was trained as a nuclear physicist. The guy had already been a governor. I mean, on paper, he would have made like the perfect president. But I remember watching this thing on the American Spectator on PBS about his tenure. And it just occurred to me that at every single possible decision point in his presidency, he seemed to make the wrong decision.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He made one of the best decisions ever. He hired economist Alfred Kahn from Cornell, who issued a report saying we have to deregulate all the major industries in the country. And he did. And that's what helped set off the boom of the 1980s, the deregulation.
Yeah. You've explained this before, and I'm glad you did, because, I mean, from what you're saying, basically kind of half of Reagan's success can be attributed to what Carter did. Absolutely. Because Carter assumed he was going to win re-election, you know?
Yeah, well, the thing is, he installed G. William Miller as the head of the Federal Reserve, who was a total disaster because the money supply skyrocketed. under Miller, and that gave us the double-digit inflation of the late 70s and early 80s until Volcker came in 79 and really put the crunch on the money supply and drove interest rates up to over 20%. And we had the greatest recession since the Great Depression up until then. But the inflation rate went from 12% to 3% in a couple of years. And that helped set off the 1980s boom when you had inflation at a very reasonable rate compared to the double digits of the late 70s and early 80s. So low inflation is consistent with prosperity, sustainable prosperity. But the central bank, the Federal Reserve, gets out of control and pumps money in like crazy under Greenspan, under Bernanke, under Yellen, and now under Powell. And so that's what's given us the inflation and the bubbles in the past.
Are we ever going to reach the point where this can we perfect a capitalist economy and our society to the point where this runs smooth, more or less permanently? We never will.
That's why I wrote Tax-Free 2000 in 1995. It was published. That points out that if we get rid of virtually all the taxes that we have and just run the government on a very lean basis and, again, decentralize, phase out Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, have the nonprofit sector take up the slack, because people won't have to pay all these onerous taxes. They'll be able to fund the local nonprofits in their area. When we moved to Naples last year, there was a big campaign by Habitat for Humanity. So we have a charitable trust account, and I wrote a nice check to Habitat for Humanity because they do great work. That's how you help people directly without having a government bureaucracy and people who don't provide any services in the government, but you have the Habitat Humanity gets the volunteers and they build housing for people. What's the best way to help people? I helped create a nonprofit health center in Northern New Jersey when we lived there. Again, no government involvement. People make donations, corporations, businesses make donations, doctors donate their time and to provide health care for low-income folks. And that's how it works. That's the nonprofit way of America.
I've been on this the last month. This is our 20th show, so we've been on doing this for 6 weeks, about the fact that so much of our tax money is wasted, and like you said, our federal tax rates are still so high, relatively speaking, that I just wondering if at some point I remind everybody that this country was started based on a tax revolt. And why shouldn't that happen again? I mean, what point do we get to where the public just says, no, bullshit, I'm not paying?
Well, no. I think what's happening, and we've seen this the last few years, is that they just keep on borrowing money to pay the government's bills rather than raise taxes. And if they're going to raise taxes, they're going to do it on the top 5% of income earners, which are not a big voting block in the country. Again, the politicians in Washington have figured it out, especially the Democrats. If they want to increase government spending, they're going to borrow more money, increase taxes on the wealthy and corporations, and think that's going to give them a good outcome. But it's not, because there's a limit to how much debt can be floated by governments. And I think we're starting to see that China, Japan, Russia, Korea, the Middle East countries, they may be reaching the saturation point in terms of how much debt they're willing to buy at these interest rates, because we know these interest rates probably in the long term are not going to be at these levels. We may see double-digit inflation back by the end of this decade. If we go into another recession, the Fed's going to pump the money supply up again, and then we'll be off to the races for another cycle.
And this is, now I remember what I was going to say 15 minutes ago when I blacked out. So all the other thing I've been saying reading recently, people are now starting to become, I've read analysts are becoming sensitive to the fact that the interest on the debt is becoming freaking enormous.
This is the big warning sign, because what that means is that there'll be less money for other programs. So if they want to keep the level of spending for those programs up, then the budget's really going to go through the roof, because now the interest, I think, is approaching close to $1 trillion a year.
Yeah, that's what I heard too.
That's just an enormous amount of interest on the national debt. And if interest rates stay at these levels and go up during this decade, we may see at the end of this decade the interest on the national debt be $2 trillion a year.
Yeah.
So we're headed for a financial crisis, the likes of which we've probably never seen in U.S. history.
Right. That's well, and I tell you what, let's leave it at that. I'm going to ask you, Murray, if you could send me some links to a couple of the things you mentioned, those two books from the 1980s you're talking about, and also a couple of the books you I could find them because we used to link to them years ago. So if you could send me that, I'd appreciate it, and we'll put a link up to your Substack blog, which everybody should subsubscribe to.
So, great, thanks, Jim.
I want to thank you for talking with us tonight. This is always it's always illuminating, always. So
great to be with you, Jim.
Yeah, you take care, Murray. I'll see you soon, okay? Bye-bye.
Bye.
Murray Sabrin from Florida. God, the guy knows. It's like, and you know, he's right. We're just headed to, I don't think that's tinfoil hat bullshit. We're headed toward a catastrophe. We are. You know, he was talking about the interest on the debt. The interest is now $1 trillion a year. And you think about this. If the for example, hypothetically, if the interest rate on that debt goes up from 5% to 7%, so then it's increased about 20%. You're talking about hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars all of a sudden. You know, that needs to be serviced. It's terrible. All right, you can call me up, jim@knight.com/call. Otherwise, I'm going to end tonight with this, and that is a bunch of Mexicans. I sound terrible when they're talking about a bunch of people in Mexico say they've unearthed two extraterrestrial bodies, which were basically calcified. They were fossilized. So this is not anything new. They said these bodies are thousands of years old. I think they found them digging up some a project for a skyscraper or something like that. I'm not really sure. And they put them on display. They even took them in glass coffins to the Mexican legislature so the Mexican congressman could see them. Except the thing is, this is probably bullshit because there's been so many false flags and there's been so much hoaxes, so many hoaxes regarding ET in Mexico, at this point, you can't even believe any of it. I mean, there's so many people in Mexico who have trotted out in the past supposed alien bodies that have turned out not to be true. You know, you can only cry wolf so much, you know. Although there is a point to be made here, and that is, you know, the ancient alien astronaut thing, you know, if these people have been around for thousands of years, you'd think someone would have unearthed a real live dead body somewhere, you know, or corpse somewhere. You'd think that. If they were around that much. Maybe they're just good at cleaning up after themselves. I don't know. All right, folks. Tomorrow, we got on Jazz Shaw. Talked to him. He's fabulous. I love these guests. You know, Murray's fantastic. I can't say enough about this guy. And also, the thing is, you need to get educated in this stuff. I hope you listen to this. I mean, I know that was 45 minutes long. I don't care. Because the thing is, nobody in America knows anything about economics. I mean, I talk to my friends, and I hate to say this, especially my liberal friends. They will pontificate and pontificate. They don't have a clue. And the deal is, I'm not that educated on it, but I know more than the vast majority of people. And that's scary, you know? I mean, Murray's an expert. Murray's been doing this forever, you know? I'm just a casual layman reader, you know? I read about economics. I do find it fascinating. You know, because the thing about money is that in some ways it does not exist. You know, I mean, it's not really real in the sense that it's just basically a method of barter at the end of the day. It is. And also the fact that basically the entire currency supply rests largely on trust. You know, I mean, that's how come in 2009 we apparently came 5 hours away from the entire world economy collapsing, supposedly. You know, because if you lose the trust, the whole thing's fucked. So it's a fascinating thing, but you should know about it. I hope that we can supply that here. I'm looking at the red light now because the thing is now we're going to go. So tomorrow, Jazz Shaw. Next week, Mark Tapscott and a couple other people. I'm Jim Peters. Thanks for watching. Good night, Uncle Donnie, wherever you are. I'll see you tomorrow. Take care.